Plane loads of diplomats and journalists will be flying into Hanoi this week for the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. President Bush arrives on Friday for the meeting, which will be something of a coming-out party for Vietnam. The foreign guests won't see a war-torn, poverty-stricken country. Things there are changing fast. Cars, motorbikes, Coca-Cola, cell phones, Levi jeans. The signs are everywhere that the country is bubbling with economic growth. After China, it's the second fastest growing economy in Asia. And like China, the government is still communist, but capitalism is fueling the economy. This newly cosmopolitan Vietnam wants the world to know it's ready to take its place in the global community. Today, an inside look at Vietnam. How is it changing? And what does it mean for the people who live there? Later, we will be talking with actor and director Emilio Estevez about his new movie, Bobby, an evocative look at the day Robert Kennedy was assassinated. But first, inside modern Vietnam. If you have questions about what Vietnam today is like or why, we'd like to hear from you. And if you've been there recently or if you have family there, what do you think of the way it's changing? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, and our email address is talk@npr.org. Our first guest is Dana Sachs. She is the author of The House on Dream Street, memoir of an American woman in Vietnam. And she's traveled frequently to Vietnam since 1990. She joins us now from member station WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina. Good to have you with us, Dana.
Hi, Lynn.
I know you recently spent a year in Hanoi, and I wonder if you can just give us a sense of what it's like there now. What's it like to walk down the streets and the alleyways of Hanoi?
Well, I'll give you an example. The street that I lived on was in the center of town, in the center of the big capital, but it was a small dead end with the motorbike washing service at one end, and the other end was a small intersection. Between my house and the intersection, it took me about maybe 90 seconds to walk, and there were probably 15 different small entrepreneurs that had their little shops and stands right there on the street that I could pass by. So there were tea stalls and little tiny restaurants and people selling cigarettes and everything just right there on the corner, a tofu lady.
I also get the impression that there are like motor scooters whirring about.
Oh, yeah. Motor scooters have taken over. When I first went there in the early 1990s, it was mostly bicycles. Now it's mostly motorbikes, and the traffic situation is terrible. Just across the street there, you have to sort of take your life into your own hands.
Well, how has it changed since you first went there in the early 90s? In what other ways has it changed?
Uh-huh. I mean, that's definitely the most obvious. That's the thing that people always mention when they say, oh, it's changed so much here. Do you notice all the motorbikes? But I notice other kinds of changes in the way people live their lives. When I lived there in the early 1990s, there was a lot of time to just sit around and hang out with friends, or you could ride your bike to somebody's house and spend the whole day there. Now people are really busy. They have a lot of jobs, and they have a lot of stress in their lives, and they have a lot of, it's not exactly that they have more expenses than they had before, but they want more, and they have the access to more things, so they're working a lot harder, and they have more opportunities to buy more. So there's not the time to sit around and just relax that there used to be.
So maybe all the changes are not for the good, or...
I think people would probably, I mean, I can't speak for everybody there, but I think people have mixed feelings about it. I think in general, people are very happy with the changes and the opportunities that they have in their lives. And they can see hope for their children. And maybe 10 or 15 years ago, they didn't have that hope. But they also see that they lose something in terms of sort of family life or friendships by just simply not having the time that they had before.
What about new building in the city? I mean, when you see pictures, for instance, of Shanghai in China, for example, the skyline has just changed completely and there's just constant building going on. Is that going on in Hanoi as well? Is the economic growth happening as quickly in Vietnam as it has in China?
Well, I can't really compare it to China because I don't know that situation so well. But it's a huge issue in Hanoi now, because Hanoi is an old French colonial city. It actually is about to celebrate its 1,000-year anniversary. It goes back very, very far. But the French really transformed the city into this beautiful cosmopolitan center with gorgeous villas and boulevards. And there's a real debate going on now about what in the city can stay and what needs to be torn down. Some of the villas are very worn down now, and it would be extremely expensive to renovate them. So you see things coming down. Like I rode my bike all the time past this, it was a two-story French building that used to have a cafe in it. It was a beautiful old brick building. And then one day I rode by and it was completely gone. It was just the site of a construction. So that can be really depressing. But I think everybody feels that there has to be a balance, and they haven't really found what that balance is going to be yet.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Dana.
Thank you.
Dana Sachs is author of The House on Dream Street, Memoir of an American Woman in Vietnam, and also of the forthcoming novel, If You Lived Here. She joined us from member station WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina. And joining us now to tell us some more about what's behind some of these changes in Vietnam is Peter Zinnemann. He is Associate Professor of History at the University of California at Berkeley, and the founding editor of the Journal of Vietnamese Studies. And he joins us from a studio on the campus of UC Berkeley. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What is fueling these changes in Vietnam that we've just been talking about?
Well, the biggest factor was a series of reforms that was introduced by the Communist Party in the mid-1980s that are typically referred to under the name renovation. During the early 80s, Vietnam's economy basically began to go down the tubes. There was widespread famine. Thousands and thousands of people were fleeing Vietnam by boat, not necessarily because of political repression, but because of economic devastation. At the same time, reforms, economic reforms and to some extent political reforms, were being introduced into China and the Soviet Union. And the Vietnamese state, the Vietnamese party state, saw the writing on the wall, realized that it would probably not be able to survive given the current economic situation. And so it embarked on this very radical program of reforms. This new policy liberalized the economy. It opened the door of the economy for foreign investment. It allowed Vietnamese to be businessmen and entrepreneurs, something that wasn't permitted in Vietnam in the old communist system.
Is their growth very similar to China's? I mean, we have the same dynamic sort of happening there, the communist government, and yet capitalism sort of fueling the economic growth.
It is similar. The timing is quite similar. You see a very similar attempt to keep a lid on the political system or to maintain this relatively old-fashioned authoritarian communist political system while simultaneously opening the economy. And the Chinese have shown that this can be done with really quite spectacular economic results, and we're seeing the same thing in Vietnam.
What about political dissent, freedom of religion, freedom of speech? What's happening in that area?
Well, I think to some extent, because the economic reforms have been so successful, political dissent and voices in favor of greater political liberalization have been muted to some extent. There is still a small dissident community in Vietnam. There's groups of intellectuals, old party members who are not happy with some of the issues involving corruption. The party retains a relatively tight grip on religious institutions, and so you get some complaints and activism on the part of religion. The party is more or less, I think, because they've been able to engineer this incredible growth, 7-8% over the last decade, has been able to keep a lid on this and to prevent these small rumblings of dissent from gaining a kind of mass, a mass audience. We've never seen anything in Vietnam since the reforms were introduced 20 years ago, remotely like the Tiananmen Square events in China.
All right, let's see if we can get a call in here now. Nick in Lansing, Michigan. Go ahead.
Good afternoon.
Go ahead, Nick.
All right. I'm curious, with the large economic growth in Vietnam, is that creating a social change within Vietnam, such as a decrease in poverty and an increase in the middle class?
Yes, it is doing both of those things. As I mentioned, growth in Vietnam has averaged about 8% over the last 6 or 7 years. And we've also seen a quite dramatic increase in the poverty rate. In the early 90s, the World Bank estimated that about 60% of the population lived in poverty. Today, it's about 18%. And what that means is that this really quite dramatic growth that's being generated is not being concentrated in too intense a way in the hands of the very few. There's something about this growth, something about its mechanisms, that's allowing it to be distributed in a way that is trickling down to the bottom, and many people are benefiting from it.
But are there regional differences, I wonder? I mean, are things better in the city as opposed to rural areas? Or
there are regional differences. Things are better in the city compared to the rural areas. And significantly, things are better or at least richer in the south. So per capita income in Vietnam is currently, I think, about $700 a year. In Saigon, the capital of the south, it's about $2,000 a year. And the south has been able to take advantage of these new economic policies introduced in the 80s much more quicker and much more successfully than in the north. And it's not hard to understand why.
All right, we're gonna save that for when we come back after a short break, Peter. We're talking with Peter Zinnemann about Vietnam. It's a very different country today than what many Americans might remember. If you have any questions, give us a call at 800-989-TALK or send us an email to talk@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, and we're talking about Vietnam today. Most Vietnamese today are under the age of 30, and they don't even remember the Vietnam War. The economy's booming. There's a new word among younger Vietnamese, stress. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes and about what all this change is doing to the Vietnamese culture. Right now, our guest is Peter Zinnemann, Associate Professor of History at UC Berkeley and the founding editor-in-chief of the Journal of Vietnamese Studies. You're invited to join the discussion if you have any questions about Vietnam or if you've been there recently or if you have family there. What do you think of the way it's changing? The number is 800-989-TALK. Or send us an email to talk@npr.org. Professor Zinnemann, we were talking just before the break. You were saying that things seem to be a little bit better in the south and in the north, and I just was wondering if there is still tension between north and south left over from the war years.
Yeah, there is tension. Some of the tension is a result of this more recent uneven economic development, whereby the South has been getting a lot richer and doing a lot better than the North, and that generates some resentment. But there's also enduring antagonism from the war years. You remember that the war lasts from the mid-50s to the mid-70s. It's 20 years. It's an incredibly brutal and violent struggle. And when the North and the Southern Communists are victorious in 1975, they introduce relatively harsh measures against the Southerners who they've defeated. There's a large system of re-education camps that's set up. A lot of the wealth of the South is taken away. And there's an effort to impose this sort of Stalinist economic system on the South in a very rapid time frame. And so the decade after the end of the war, from 1975 to 1985, Southerners really feel like they're living in sort of occupied territory. Northern carpetbaggers come down to the South during this time and take over many of the major institutions. And still today, you know, it's not unusual in the South to see the heads of big institutions, the heads of hospitals, the heads of universities, the heads of offices to be from the North. And there's understandable a sense of resentment as a result of this.
All right, let's go to Elizabeth, who's calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I was in Vietnam, in Hanoi, about 15 months ago, and I think I was it was a lot of culture shock for me. I think that I, even though I'm hearing about how far things have come, it was still pretty intimidating. You still can't brush your teeth with the water. The water system is, and the sewage system really isn't very good. The medical care was very bad, and I definitely did not see a KFC or a McDonald's or anything when I was there.
All right. Well, Peter Zinnemann, it seems to me Elizabeth is saying that perhaps Vietnam has a ways to go. Maybe we've oversold this idea that things are changing rapidly. And thanks for your call, Elizabeth. I'm going to ask.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, there's a lot of reason to be optimistic about Vietnam's current course and its future. It's made incredible strides since this very dark period that I described in the mid-80s. But there's still very significant problems. This kind of central problem of how to continue to produce economic growth while having this really quite draconian, authoritarian political structure on top has not been solved. And there hasn't really been open debate or discussion about how to deal with this. And there's connected problems with this, such as the problem of corruption, which really, you know, has grown explosively, you know, precisely as a consequence of this dynamic economic growth and this kind of stultifying political system. And it's one of the things that's during the last 20 years, there's been a general sense of growth. There's also been some downturns, and there's been some hesitancy on the part of foreign investors, and much of it grows out of that.
All right, let's bring in – I wanted to bring in another guest now who is standing by with me here in Studio 3A, Andrew Lamb, and he is the editor with New American Media, and he is an editor with New American Media, and he's also the author of Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora. He is Vietnamese-American, and he occasionally does commentaries for All Things Considered. And as I said, he is with me here in Studio 3A. Thanks for being here.
Hi.
And he's been listening all along. I wanted to start, first of all, Andrew, by asking you to respond to that last call. Up until that moment, I think we've been saying, oh, things are really changing so rapidly in Vietnam, and the economy's booming, but obviously there's still poverty there.
Well, there's still a lot of poverty, and things are improving, but it's not as if somehow the third world has turned into the first world simply because of economic growth in the last 7 or 8 years. And yet, the optimism is actually there, and you can feel it when you're there, and this love of energy among young people. You can't deny that either. It doesn't mean just because they don't have KFC that, you know, they have not made progress.
Right.
In fact, KFC is coming into Vietnam if the caller would come back in about 6 months. Yet, you know, there is a lot of identity crisis along with this progress because materialism suddenly becomes such a central modus operandi, so that people are, you know, in this mode, what they call, you know, grab and pull, because they got to make more money, got to have more things.
Say that again.
Jip yuk.
And what does that mean exactly?
Jip yuk is grab and pull.
Uh-huh.
It means you have to get more things and got to do more.
Yeah, and
more
you
things.
Also did a commentary recently for All Things Considered where you talked about the fact that the Vietnamese young people now use the English word stress a lot. Why is that?
Because there is no exact expression for it in Vietnamese. I mean, in Vietnamese, there is an expression that say căng thẳng thần kinh, means something like a tension of the mind. But stress is actually a very new phenomenon. It's not about hard labor, you know, working agricultural life, but it's about modern life, learning new stuff, and therefore you're constantly balancing, you know, learning English, learning computer while, you know, running your own business. And they couldn't find an equivalent in Vietnamese, so everyone say, si stress, yao nay em si stress, wa? You know, like, recently I'm so stressed.
Right.
Because the word stress seems to apply to their modern condition more than any Vietnamese word they could find.
So is this changing what it means to be Vietnamese? I mean, is it really changing the cultural identity?
I suspect that it has. I think it has changed since the war ended and the Vietnamese diaspora began, and more Vietnamese sending money home, sending images of themselves transformed overseas. And when Clinton lifted the trade embargo in 1994, it seems like such a profound change in Vietnam, where they suddenly saw themselves no longer isolated but somehow participant in a new kind of global society. And I think Bush coming in, by the next few days, seems to reaffirm this idea that Vietnam is no longer sort of a subservient class and we're at the southeast corner of Asia.
All right, let's take a call. I want to go to Boyd, and he is calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Boyd.
Hi, everyone. I have a question, and it's basically, I happened to, many, many years ago, had the chance to go to China, and this was in the late 80s, and I was always intrigued with going to Vietnam at one point. It seems one of the things, and you mentioned this, Lynn, was how with all these changes is it affecting the culture? And that, I think, concerns me, too, because I think a lot of countries, not just in Asia, but you're seeing this more and more in Europe, are very leery of becoming Americanized. When someone did mention there was Kentucky Fried Chicken, but then a previous caller said there isn't any of those, I would think the Vietnamese would want to be very protective of their culture and be very selective of what they let in.
Is that the sense there, Andrew, that there people don't want to let too much in? Or I don't get the sense that that's how people are feeling.
I think there is a tension between the older generation and the younger generation. Mm-hmm. And the older generation and also the ruling class are constantly warning about the decadent West, about all this information that could corrupt the young minds. But young people have been isolated in previous generation. And when the doors opened and the borders became porous, they coveted the West. So in fact, it's almost the opposite between what the old people want and the younger people want.
All right, thanks for your call, Boyd. What about young people's awareness of the war? How aware are they of it? I mean, what was it? I forget what the percentage was, but a large number of Vietnamese now are under the age of 30 and really don't have a memory of the war.
Yeah, but the same way you would ask a teenager here how he feels about Watergate and what do you think his response might be, And not only that, but I was in Vietnam a couple years ago with a few other American journalists, and they say, go ask, since you speak Vietnamese, ask that guy what he thinks of the war. So I came over and I say, what do you think of the war? And his response was, which one? Because, of course, Americans tend to think of Vietnam as the Vietnam War.
Right.
But Vietnam had fought the French and then the Chinese and the Americans and occupied Cambodia. So the Vietnam War was just part of this long string of chronology.
Yeah.
From their perspective, it's all in the past. It all belongs to the historical chapters. And so Vietnam is more forward-looking than you might imagine.
Yeah. Let me get Professor Zinnemann back in here. Peter Zinnemann, what about the lingering effects of the war? We were talking about that earlier in terms of the tension between North and South. Are there other lingering effects?
Well, I think this generational shift that Andrew mentions is clearly important. For the older generation, they went through long periods of scarcity, of hardship, of conflict. And I think it very profoundly shaped their values, in the same way that Americans who lived through the Depression or one of our world wars were profoundly shaped by that. For the younger generation, that experience only comes to them through the propaganda arms of the state. It's something that's force-fed to them in school and museum exhibits and TV documentaries. It doesn't really seem real to them, and yet they're constantly being told to respect it and to think about it. And I think this creates a certain degree of generational alienation, perhaps greater than you would find in a society normally.
And Andrew, is there any sense among the younger generation, is there any dissatisfaction with the communist government, and all that might entail?
Well, I think increasingly you see political dissidents that belong to the younger generation. There were a few who were cyberspace dissidents who translated U.S. Constitution into Vietnamese and got arrested and so on. But that's a very small population. I think that in general, the political consciousness of the population is not there yet. There is not yet a civil society, no platform to discuss national projects and independent thinking. And so it's a long way from having political consciousness, I
you
think.
You expect it to develop?
I do. I expect that to develop as more middle-class people come in and also more information, more access to information, more people reading in English and so on. But I think it's a slow process. It doesn't happen overnight.
Andrew Lam is the editor, is an editor with New America Media and the author of Perfume Dreams, Reflections of the Vietnamese Diaspora. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. All right, we're going to take a call now. We're going to go to PJ, who is in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, PJ.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome. Go right ahead.
I'm a Vietnamese-American. My mom came to this country in 1972, and I was born in 1974. I have only been back to Vietnam once in 2004 because all of my mom's side of the family is still there, although she has been back many times. The only comment I wanted to make is that we're from the South. My mom's family, and so I didn't go to Hanoi. The farthest I went was the middle of the country, which is Hue. And I just wanted to make the comment that my mom has been supporting her family for the last, since she's been here, and from 1972 onward. And even though the Vietnamese economy has welcomed capitalism to a certain extent, I feel like the profits of capitalism are not trickling down to maybe the people in the lowest socioeconomic rungs, because my mom is still having to continually send money over there. She can't even send it. She usually doesn't want it to be stolen, so she kind of has to either hand-deliver it or she has some certain system set up. So I was wondering if any of your commenters could talk a little bit about that from the people's perspective, where at the same time they're being stifled, yet they're allowed some means of gaining wealth. Could they make a comment about that, please?
I saw, Andrew Lam, you were shaking your head as you were listening to this comment.
Well, I think it's true that there is a sector that's still deprived of a lot of, you know, the existence of money. And in fact, one of the major problems Vietnam face now is the rural population that are now facing a situation where they have to sell their daughters or their children to trafficking situations, say in Taiwan or Korea. And that is becoming a big, big problem in Vietnam, in a sense, because the poor-rich gap is widening for those who don't have access. And, you know, I think it's going to be a long time before some of these folks will be sort of crossing to the right side of the economic story.
Peter Zinnemann, I wonder if you could respond to that caller's question. And PJ, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think the caller is right that the fruits of this economic boom have not trickled down everywhere equally. And you can identify sectors in the Vietnamese economy or in the Vietnamese population that have suffered. For example, ethnic minorities. Now, Vietnam has about 55 different ethnic groups. The Vietnamese, the King, are the biggest, obviously, and the most powerful. But these other groups, many of whom practice slash and burn agriculture, live in mountainous regions, are unsettled. They have fared relatively poorly under this new economic regime. There's been an influx of Vietnamese into the areas where they live. Land has been taken away from them, and there's been quite significant political problems with these groups protesting, fleeing Vietnam, going to Cambodia over the last 5 years as a result of these inequities that they've been subjected to. You can also see if you travel to the cities of Vietnam, I think during any period except for this week, lots of poor people on the street, and as Andrew mentioned, a lot of them are migrants from the countryside. It's interesting that during this APEC conference, we're getting pretty sort of scary reports that the state has been rounding up these homeless people, poor people, shoeshine boys, postcard sellers, and taking them outside of the city to places where they can't be in the camera lights. So the government is aware that these folks are around and are not benefiting from this new system, and they're very concerned their image doesn't cloud the much rosier image that they're hoping to project to the world this week.
So there could be some political unrest brewing there, possibly, in some parts of the country.
Well, there already is. I mean, in these minority areas, there's been quite significant public uprisings. And there's also been some rural dissent. There's a province outside of Hanoi called Taibing, which has seen quite significant peasant protests in the last 5 years.
Peter, thanks so much for being with us today. Peter Zinnemann is Associate Professor of History at UC Berkeley. We're going to continue this discussion with Andrew Lam when we come back from a short break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And right now we're going to conclude our conversation about the new Vietnam. My guest is Andrew Lam, and he is the editor of New America magazine and an author of Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora. And I'd like to take a call now. We're going to go to Mike, and he's calling from Tucson, Arizona. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Vietnam has a long history of the practice of Buddhism. Nearby in China, for example, the government there sought to squash Buddhism, for example, in Tibet. I'm wondering what the attitude today is of the Vietnamese government toward Buddhist practice in the country.
Well, there's two sectors. The condoned Buddhist sector is under the control of the Vietnamese government and are allowed to practice. And then there is sort of the underground Buddhist sectors that constantly are persecuted. But Vietnam is around 75% to 80% Buddhist, so it's not as if they can squash it, because that's sort of squashing the majority of the people. In fact, if anything, because of the age of materialism and the enormous transition, there's a lot of people who are confused and are looking for spiritual meaning in their life. And that's one thing that I find surprising every time I go back to Vietnam, is to see temples and churches filled with young people as well.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, and thanks for your call, Mike. It's interesting that you bring that up, Andrew, the idea that as a country like Vietnam becomes more in better shape economically, and obviously from what you've been saying, there's a lot of emphasis among young people on materialism, that a spiritual vacuum can be created.
Absolutely. I think that's also the case in China. People, especially places like Vietnam, where every generation had been called to arms or called for some movement or another. And to make money is maybe glorious, but in fact it's not a national project. It's not a collective movement. You make money for yourself. And so I've seen young people who've made a lot of money but are terribly confused and couldn't find a direction larger than their own life. And this is the first time in maybe 5 or 6 generation when this happened. So, of course, they look for spiritual meaning in their life.
All right. We're going to go to Gregory now. He's calling from Cave Creek, Arizona. Hi, Gregory.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
The thing about Vietnam, with all this incredible growth, you know, high-rises going up everywhere in Saigon, all these new businesses, people are working like crazy to make money. In the town of Hoi An near Da Nang, I talked to a woman in a tailor shop. They have about 200 tailor shops there. This woman was working 14 hours a day, 7 days a week. Isn't it unlikely that that can be stopped anytime soon?
Well, not as long as people desire to make more money, to have a better life for themselves and their children. I think the engine of economic growth is there to stay unless something disastrous happens. But I don't see any, you know, slowing down anytime soon.
Do you think that this is that what Gregory is describing? Is it always a situation where that's what people want to be doing, or that they just that they have to be doing that in order to?
I think there is.
All these women seem just trapped. They felt this constant pressure, and I think some came from, you know, their parents or whatever. But this woman was saying, "Do you know anybody that I can marry?" She wanted to escape so bad.
Well, I mean, life is still laborious and difficult for a large population of Vietnam. So, of course, that's certainly a case. But and marrying to someone with a higher position, of course, is a way to escape. But I think in some way you have to look in the past as well. I mean, as a country of 85% agricultural population in the past, and life in the rural has always been arduous. So it's not as if they just found themselves working hard suddenly. I think it's always been a hard-working life, but in fact, it's the first time where they actually see an ascendancy for themselves.
All right, let's go to Bridget. She's in Kansas City. Hi, Bridget.
Hi, how are you? Thank
Good,
you for
thanks.
Taking my call. My question was, I had a student do a research paper on Vietnam, and she brought up the fact that a lot of the Vietnamese suffered from Agent Orange and DDT drop during the war, and I was just wondering, has the economic growth led to improvement in the health services that your guests could maybe talk about a little bit? Thank you.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Well, Agent Orange has been a long ongoing problem since the war started, since they dropped the Agent Orange in the middle of the war. And yes, there are cases in which people have birth defects and so on. But I think there is a bigger environmental problem that usually does not get covered in the United States, simply because we're so interested in those Agent Orange because we're responsible for it. Since the Vietnam War ended, Vietnam went from 35 to 84. 4 million people, and a large population of this population live on forest or deforestation products and so on in order to survive. So the deforestation situation in Vietnam has gotten to a critical stage. Economic growth is happening, but the environmental effect in the rural, in the countryside, is getting to a point where unless there is a conscious effort to stave off that situation, I think it's going to be a disaster in coming.
All right, and let's go to Jason. He's in the Bay Area in California. Hi, Jason.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Look, I was just over in Vietnam in May and June of this year, and I just wanted to make a comment that I took my family over there, and what a great country it was. There's so many misconceptions about Vietnam, and especially here in America, about the war. And, look, I just wanted to say we were welcomed with open arms. My kids were treated like rock stars. They're 4.5 and 3 years old, and we couldn't walk a block without being stopped by people. But my only concern is that they can balance the effect of, because they've got such a beautiful culture, that they can balance their culture and also the strive for economic prosperity.
Did you feel like you were already seeing signs that... I don't know, that the culture was changing in a way that if you went back in 5 years, you might not recognize the country that you visited this year?
In a big way.
Yeah.
In a big way, because when we originally came from Australia, but and our first stop was Saigon, or Ho Chi Minh City, and they're like workaholics over there. That's like they're on a mission there. I work in construction, and I was just observing, some of the building in the main downtown area, and they were working till like midnight. They were getting out the lights and all that, and I would imagine in a 5 years time, the whole landscape of not so much the countryside, but as far as the cities are concerned, I think it would be a big change there in 5 years, especially if they're going to be in the WTO.
Right. Well, thanks so much for your call, Jason.
Okay, thanks.
So big challenges ahead for Vietnam, it seems like. Andrew, you seem very excited about the changes, but you're going to have to write a thin line that the country doesn't lose its uniqueness.
I think so. And I think one of the major problems among the young people now is when I say a cultural identity crisis, I don't mean just identity itself, but behavioral changes that would be shocking just 2 generations back. For instance, in Vietnam now, young people are having sex at much younger age mm-hmm. than before. Women don't treasure virginity like, 3 generations past. It's almost, if I could put it, a sexual revolution the way the U.S. went through, the 60s and so on. And that's exactly what's happening in the cities of Vietnam, to the point where you have, young women wearing bras on the street, which is shocking to Vietnamese who had been a long tradition of modesty. And I think all of that stuff is now being played out on public sphere.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew Lam is an editor with New America Media, and he's the author of Perfume Dreams, Reflections, and the Vietnamese Diaspora.